Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights and debate in development studies.
I'm going to talk about the southernisation of development. Okay, let's jump straight in. So this was from a couple of days ago. It's not often that sort of, you watch the news and day by day you can update your PowerPoint, but we're at that moment in British aid. So this is the current International Development Secretary arguing that Britain needs to make a change in its definition and therefore use of overseas development assistance, or ODA, or more commonly called foreign aid. And actually, the changes that she's suggesting have almost no impact on the ODA budget. They're very, very small, but symbolically they're very important. The fact that she's trying to change it at all tells us something about the current situation in the UK and elsewhere, and I'll run through and talk about this. I gave something nearly like this talk a few weeks ago, and this is my starting slide. This has just been announced by the government in the States. The United States, under Trump, has agreed to finance a new development finance agency. It's very specifically around financing private sector equity and debt. And, of course, this is the presidency that's threatening to cut USAID, the US aid funds. This new international development finance corporation is very much pitched as part of the USA's need to take the commercial battlefield with China on. But it's interesting that they are doing so specifically through a development institution, or at least through a development narrative, that they're using a Development Act and so on. So I'll come back to this about why these stories are so important. Some of you will be very familiar with this schematic by Gillian Hart, looking at the different sorts of international political economy regimes in relation to international development. For some years now, I've argued that, and Gillian Hart, I'm sure, would be the very first to say that it's a thin schematic, but, of course, what this schematic misses off is the southern story of development, of intentional development activity, and different sorts of ideological or programmatic regimes like the demand for the new international economic order. And then in more recent years, some of my work has been about what's happening post-2008. And that's where this present talk comes from. So what I want to argue is not just that the North is moving south. That's going to be my discussion today, if you like. But following David Hume and Rory Horner and others, thinking about a more polycentric and more complex development landscape, we see across the development landscape today a really remarkable turbulence, and in many ways a very productive turbulence, convergence, collaboration, competition, co-option, and so on. To the extent that these simplistic, if you like, methodologically nationalist ideas exist, a few years ago, let's say 2000s, early 2000s, the question really was, in mainstream circles perhaps, how was the West going to socialise the rising powers, particularly China, of course, but India, Brazil and others, into the becoming proper donors? So people like Richard Manning were writing very intelligently. Richard Manning is not a sort of, in any way, a sort of simplistic drumbeater for the DAC, but writing about the what the perceived desirability of a more cooperative and relationship between the DAC donors and the southern donors. And then people like Adriana Abdeno and Harald Fonseca, Devon Curtis, looking with more concern about this idea of the South being co-opted by the North, being kind of disciplined by the North. And if we think about the sort of long-standing tutelary tropes about the North teaching the South, this seems like just the last one, the one of many before it, where the North would teach the South how to become proper donors. So a good example of this is Robert Zoellick talking in 2005. He said, China's big, it's growing, it's going to influence, you know. So for the United States, the question is, how will China use its influence? And he says, we need to urge China to become a responsible stakeholder in the global system. I always want to point out at this point, Robert Zoellick was one of the original signatories to the project of the New American Century that urged in the late 1990s the invasion of Iraq, the moment they had an even kind of remotely plausible event. So this is not a man who ought to be talking about responsible world powers. Nonetheless, he doesn't stop him preaching at China. So my question then is what about a sort of north to south direction of travel? Is there what we could call, cautiously, a southernization of the international development regime? And I want to say from the start, I'm trying to stand back from any normative judgments over whether this is a good or a bad thing. We can come at the end and maybe to the questions. There's no inherent view that the southernization of development is simplistically good or bad. It's much more complicated, and we can talk about that maybe at the end. So before we get on with this, what's the problem with the title, if you like? Southernization perhaps implies methodological nationalism, the idea of southern states. We're thinking about China, we're thinking about Brazil. But is that the sort of the appropriate unit of analysis? Are we falling into the territorial trap? Probably not really. That's where the vast majority of official Southern Development Cooperation arises. But of course, we need to be careful that we're not overly focusing our lens on the state. Which South and which North? The Southernization, the idea potentially starts to iron out differences, very profound differences between, for example, the Latin American approach to technical cooperation, or the Asian approach, which often prizes all-round different forms of development, finance and investment and so on, and similarly, which North? So these are cautious questions. And then there's a really interesting one. When I come back to this question at the end, are we looking at what I'm going to argue could be seen as a form of southernization, shifts in northern donors and development partners in their narratives and practices and so on? Or is this in fact the elastic band springing back, with the MDG era being an outlier in international development, in the 60 years of international development, and in many ways what we're seeing now much more faithful to earlier decades of development practices and narratives? Things like geostrategic primacy, the focus on infrastructure and growth, and even the value of authoritarian leadership. So to look at it, we need to situate it in its more recent history, our current international development debates, shifts, and so on. What's been going on in the preceding era? Well, if we kind of roughly call it the MDG era, Katie Willis sort of says it was an unprecedented period of international agreement about what constituted development, clear targets, and so forth. David Hume and Sakiko Fukuda-Parr have done work on this, useful paper looking at how poverty reduction moved to become what they call the central analytic of development. Its poverty reduction had always been assumed or even explicit, but it was an explicit product of growth. Now the MDGs moved poverty reduction to the heart of the international development effort. There was apparent global consensus. It was situated in ideas of partnerships, responsibility and reform, and the emblematic form of financing was ODA, was foreign aid. So the 2002 Monterey Financing for Development Conference, the primary efforts, not the only efforts, but the primary efforts were to raise the foreign aid expenditure of the DAC donors. The DAC donors, does everyone know this? The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's basically the rich country club of donors. David and Sakiko look at why the MDGs emerged as they did in the late 1990s, early 2000s, what it was. around the end of the Cold War and the end of the Cold War interregnum that followed, around particular formative policy documents like the OECD shaping the 21st century. People power, marches, Jubilee 2000 and so forth, and around particular norm entrepreneurs like Kofi Annan and even, God help us, Tony Blair, who helped create and normalise, put into a normative regime the MDGs. So parallel and closely intertwined with the MDGs was what's called the Paris Process, which was based on the idea that both donors and recipients needed to seriously reform their aid practices and relationships in order to ensure aid effectiveness. The argument was that for decades the West had been pouring aid into the poor world, and there was very little to show for it, truthfully, that it was being either wasted or misapplied or so forth. So the idea was that under the Paris Declaration, that there would be ownership by partner countries, alignment between donors and partners, and harmonisation between donors and donors. I've just realised I sound a bit like Theresa May when I... Wow. Okay. Someone said that Theresa May does her own descant. That's what it feels like at the moment. Okay. All right, so what changed? Well, I mean, these things are never simple step changes. And almost everything I'm going to talk about has its origins earlier. It's not like the private sector's new, and we know, of course, it's not like China is new. But there seems to have been a qualitative shift around 2008, 2010, somewhere around there, that there's a concatenation of circumstances that start to lead to trends that many researchers have identified as shifting in the aid landscape, aid and development. There's the global financial crisis, of course, and all of the implications that had economically and politically within many countries in the north. The sort of exciting-looking picture on the top right is one of the panels from the 2011 Busan conference on aid effectiveness. And really, this was, I think, a key turning point when a lot of the DAC donors realised and recognised that they were not going to be able to bully and co-opt the southern partners. And moreover, more importantly in some ways, that the southern partners were essential to any conversation about aid and development. Rosalind Ivan has written about this, that once there were these invited-only spaces to which the OECD countries would be invited, they would make the policy and they'd tell everyone what it was. Now, we needed China, the OECD needed China desperately at that table. And the one I'm going to talk about, the rise of the BRICS. Of course, what we see over the course of the new millennium is the remarkable success of many southern states as development partners and providers. And elsewhere, I have talked about the material expansion. We see a very significant expansion of finances, of practices, of projects, and so forth. The ideational expansion, which is the claims, the discourses around southern development, are successfully defended against the critiques of the West and are now a very successful narrative around win-win. I'll come to a slide later on that. And the last bit I talked about was this ontological success. That is the idea of ontological security, if you like, that the southern partners gained increasing credibility and legitimacy as development actors. So it's a mistake, of course, just to focus on China. It's a mistake even to focus on the BRICS. But at this level, I want to talk particularly about these sorts of more powerful middle-income countries. And it is clear that many of these countries realised within whatever they meant, and they meant different things by development cooperation, that it was economically and politically attractive and desirable. So even as there was a decline in GDP growth earlier in around sort of 2007 to 2009, the amount invested in, well, it's called foreign aid, and this is part of the problem, however the OECD have calculated this, but on their own terms, if they've calculated it in the same way, it does show that to be growing. So it suggests that this is a valuable tool. And I'm sorry that this is a bit dated, this data, but it's certainly the same picture. Apart from Brazil, the other, certainly China and India, are both continuing to expand their financing. Okay, so what does all this mean? Why would the northern partners, and we're going to, I'm going to take the example of the UK, what do we mean by heading south? So the UK here is a bit of a leader. It's very strongly, it's a good example of what I'm going to argue, but it's really not the only one. It's not, we see this in the USA. Interestingly, we see it sometimes, I think most strongly, in what had previously been called the like-minded group. So the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, the kind of liberal lefty states have been some of the most quick out of the blocks on some of these changes. So I've got a few different examples of what I mean by southernisation. The first is an increasingly explicit assertion that aid has to work in the national interest. Now, even under Tony Blair, he talked about aid working in the national interest. This isn't new. Aid has always worked in the national interest. That's not new. What's new is that under the MDG era, there was almost a virtue made between a supposed distance between donor foreign policy and development outcomes. So if we go back to the Paris agreement, this idea that this was all about aligning around southern partners' interests. And so the language of explicit national interests was scaled back. Well, this is very much back, and it was back under the 2009 white paper, green paper, launched by the Tories. And this is the 2015 report, interestingly authored first by the Treasury and then by the Department for International Development, and it's called UK Aid, Tackling Global Challenges in the National Interest. And it's understandable why the Tories are trying to do this, of course. The combination of the toxicity of the Daily Mail and a very substantial degree of hostility, or at least scepticism, amongst large parts of the Tory voters means that they have been trying to re-engineer the narrative and to explicitly claim that aid works in the national interest. So Justine Greening in 2014, you know, is trying to sort of square the circle. It's not just good for countries we're helping, it's good for Britain too. If we get development right, we are market making, creating new investment opportunities. This frontier economy strategy is critical for safeguarding the UK's prospects in the long-term economic prospects, and at the same time helping DFID deliver on its ambition of eradicating poverty. As a geographer, I have to say the language of frontiers makes me go all prickly. You know, what do frontiers imply? A kind of a muscular cowboy approach. You know, as Japan or the Italians turn up, you kind of holster your guns and look at them through narrowed eyes. This is the frontier instantly evokes a certain set of conditions. And as I mentioned, there's lots, you can find any amount of this stuff coming from other Western countries. The Danish said we will be driven by the wish to promote Danish foreign and domestic policy interests at one and the same time. This is the kind of the arena of the post-political, as if domestic interests are all the same. So the City of London interests are the same as the homeless in Glasgow. Don't think so. And as if domestic and foreign policy interests are all the same time, these collapse into each other. And the Netherlands, our mission is to combine aid and trade activities to our mutual benefit. This is, of course, entirely possible. It's entirely feasible that you can have mutually beneficial trade. What disappears from some of this narrative is the recognition that it might not be mutually beneficial. And then how might you mitigate that? How might you ameliorate the winners and the losers in some of these plans? Where is risk distributed? I'll come back to that later. So a few years ago in a book I wrote, I came up with this table, and I used to joke when I was presenting that, you know, sort of post-structuralists in the room, look away now. It's a binary. It's a gross violence against the sort of complexity of these issues. And I also said this is about narrative framings. It's not actual kind of morals and motivations. And it's stalked me ever since. And I've sat in the back of hallways sometimes and seen this brought up and said Southern donors are all about morality and Northern donors are all about kind of their own interests and other things. It's been a real problem. But anyway, I'm going to show it again. So the argument was that a discursive framing of development cooperation, this was back in sort of 2008, which was a while ago, this has changed as well. The South has changed too. Is that whereas the West public narrative of donorship relied on charity, the South, originating in Bandung, originating in the Third Worldist spirit, originating in various forms of solidarity movements, set up that relationship narratively around opportunity. So it's moral obligation versus solidarity, expertise of experience versus the sort of superiority of Western science and so on, sympathy versus empathy, and then some of the stuff I did on the virtue of suspended obligation versus the virtue of reciprocity. Reciprocity still confers dignity on the partner, whereas charity does not confer dignity on the partner. Today, I would say if we look at this narrative framing of the DAC donors, the UK in this case, with middle-income countries and so-called frontier economies, we see a southernisation. The language that Penny Mordaunt uses, the language that Justine Greening uses or used, and Priti Patel, is that of opportunity. If you go back and look at Theresa May's South Africa speech, it's about opportunity for the UK and South Africa. The language is not that of moral obligation to the unfortunates, as much in this case as development partnership. And the expertise is mutually constituted. So the UK now works with India to work in Uganda. And the argument is that the UK brings some expertise, but India brings some other expertise of direct experience of things like whether it might be irrigation or so on, or many other things. So expertise has been reconfigured as more co-assembled between North and South. So in this case, the recipients are collaborating partners, and guess what? The North is now increasingly using the language, the emblematic language of the South, win-win and mutual development. So the second of my suggestions for the sort of southernisation of Northern aid is the recentering of private sector-led economic growth. And some of you here might have seen some of this, so it's a bit boring, but for example, Andrew Mitchell said, it is my intention to recast DFID as a government department that understands the private sector, has it at its disposal the right tools and so forth. Again, the private sector was not new in development. And some of this was not really about an external audience. Some of it was about appealing to Tory MPs and Tory voters and creating a kind of a, trying to argue that the New Labour, which has very successfully sort of commanded the international development reputation domestically, was a bunch of woolly liberals who just threw money out of helicopters. So as if New Labour hadn't been doing this. So there was a bit of an exaggeration. But nonetheless, it also represented a programmatic shift in DFID's priorities and aims and ambitions to work with the private sector. So there's lots of examples. I'll have some water while you read that. So new departments, new leaders, new appointments, new funding. Not just the expansion of existing instruments like the Commonwealth Development Corporation, but for some time now, and most recently we've seen in Penny Mordaunt's speeches, the idea that they should have a different sort of financial relationship to ODA, so that the profits from the Commonwealth Development Corporation can be counted as ODA, which effectively means cutting the foreign aid budget. All the sort of stuff around impact investment and so on. Some of the reason I started this work was I was really grabbed by this Back in 2013, I saw a story about Justine Greening giving her annual keynote address when she was Secretary of State for International Development from the floor of the London Stock Exchange, that well-known ardent champion of global growth and equality. And she said, it's a win-win partnership, and she met between the London Stock Exchange Group and DFID, which she launched. She says, the best-run stock exchange in the world. It's like, okay. It's like the global financial crisis was 5 years ago, or not, it never happened. We'll be offering their expertise to a region where capital markets are in their infancy. Again, another trope that always rears its head. And it also means the London Stock Exchange Group will have a fantastic, positive relationship with these frontier economies as they take off. And what this is doing, of course, is trying to compete with Dalal Street in Mumbai. It's trying to compete with Frankfurt. It's trying to compete with Wall Street. Is that as you provide training and partnerships with the London Stock Exchange, your new capital market makers are kind of in all sorts of ways personally, financial technologies. Knowledge bases are locked into the London Stock Exchange groups rather than other competitors. So the third one is development diplomacy. So this is a tricky one because the supposed Daily Mail audience, I think we need to be a bit more careful than to assume the Daily Mail represents their audience, really have very little sense of just how much the UK aid budget allows it to punch above its weight in certain international settings. And it's a real issue now for DFID, as we see with Theresa May trying to make the case that we need to keep partnerships going with countries like India, China, South Africa, and so on. So development diplomacy the foreign aid establishment is being reworked to try to sustain the diplomatic benefits of the UK's presence in international development, sometimes with much lower budgets in certain countries. Externally, at an international level, back in, I think it was 2012, the UK fought very, very hard to be the DAC representative on the new Global Partnership for Effective Development Cooperation. Someone in, I think it was Norway, told me kind of the UK basically put its elbows out and trampled the other DAC donors to the door to secure that position because of the potential for influencing the shape of the future development cooperation partnership. So what's really interesting right now, I think, is the partnerships that are happening with India and China. So in the case of India, the UK aid budget has gone down from about £300 million a year, which typically went into large poverty reduction programs like rain-fed agriculture in Orissa or big health programs in Uttar Pradesh, for better and for worse, with successes and failures. And it's now supposedly shrunk to about 30 million a year. In fact, there's all sorts of ways in which more money is going in and through Delhi. And what that's primarily doing is massaging economic and political relations with important Indian policymakers, politicians, and business people. So in the China example, we see the second UK-China Development Forum. So DFID is now funding these bilateral partnerships with powerful potential partners, potential competitors, to try and be in on the debate and to talk about this idea of the new collaborative partnership, which was, I mean, even 10 years ago, well, maybe 15 years ago, it really was nowhere on the radar in the MDGs that this sort of assemblage would be so important. Okay, and the last thing then is something I mentioned at the beginning is the redefining, the rerouting of ODA, foreign aid. So foreign aid has long been the object of critique from different parts of right and left. It's also been the object of efforts to sustain it, to reform it from within the establishment and from sympathetic outsiders. Whatever you think about foreign aid, it's now seriously changing. So at the moment, we've retained the 0.7 budget in the UK, but what has been going on in the last 5 years is the rerouting of that into things like the Global Challenges Research Fund, which I hope some people in this room have benefited from, but nonetheless one can make an argument about whether or not that's an opportunity cost for other possible spend. It's been increasingly directed through the Foreign Office or through the Department of Energy and Industrial Strategy. So there's even been a target to reduce the amount of British odour that goes through DFID down to sort of 78%, I think, at the moment, and probably more. So foreign aid is first of all being redefined, as we've seen with Penny Mordaunt's announcement of the CDC, and rerouted into things like the Prosperity Fund. So the Prosperity Fund narrative is not about direct poverty reduction. The Prosperity Fund narrative is about, let's say in this case, Thailand. Is it Thailand? Or Southeast Asia? Is that the UK and Southeast Asia business people and governments can work together to create economic growth and jobs, and that will lead to poverty reduction. Because we all know growth leads to poverty reduction, right? We've not been in this business for 60 years without knowing that growth, poverty reduction. You know, we are back. I described it at one conference. It's like Jurassic Park. Honestly, it's like the Tyrannosaurus of growth equals poverty reduction is back in the room and leaving development people, critical development scholars, under the table thinking, what on earth has happened? So, I just want to say that not all of these things are necessarily detrimental. It's as much about how they are pitched, about where the connective fabric lies. And from what I have, my research, I would say that we have every reason to be worried about some of the connective fabric between growth, decent jobs, and poverty reduction, and risk. So, the kind of, again, across the Northern Donors, we see this idea that ODA, foreign aid, should be retuned to leverage and catalyse private sector flows, including from venture capital, investments, pension funds, and so on. Andrew Mitchell, I think you might have seen it back there, said that DFID should take on the identity of a sovereign wealth fund, a portfolio manager, rather than an aid agency. We see new forms of finance are argued to provide the necessary billions, so the SDGs, from billions to trillions. So where do the trillions come from? They come from investment banks and venture capital. The idea, you could argue that if you, maybe I'll come back to it about heart, about what that might mean. So, yes, developed agencies as portfolio managers. Again, it's not new. Of course, state capital hybrids, depending on which or no variant of Marxism you attribute, you identify with, are hardly new. But perhaps quite innovative forms of state capital hybrid and coming around. And this requires financial logics. So there's really interesting connections with financialization, with things like Ebola bonds. And if any of you are really interested in some of the very, very cutting-edge work in development, the sort of whole fintech dev, financial technology and development, financialization and development is fascinating. So Priti Patel, again, our International Secretary of State for Development, is talking about rupee-denominated bonds and that this economic cooperation, innovative finance, drawing in venture funds and equity investments. And this is an example. You know, 2 million more people across the in India will get access finance to get jobs, start businesses, etc. It helps poorest people and returning an investment. Now, this is a public speech. She's not going to go into the details. But when you look at the details and look at some of the documentation that circulates internally within DFID around this, there's nothing more than that. There's, if you like, the sort of theory of change is not there, not that I found. And I'm, you know, just an academic, and I was talking to a guy who, I didn't even know that this man existed, someone, the head of international development at the Bank of England. And I'd just been through a report about financialisation and development, and the only risk that was mentioned all the way through of increasing the financialisation of sub-Saharan Africa, so increasing the capitalisation of their stock markets and things like that, the only way that risk was drawn into the debate was the risk to investors and what DFID and other donors would do to mitigate against the risk for investors. And I said, what about the risk for countries and people who, you know, kind of ordinary folks? Where does that risk come in? You know, global financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, is it just I'm not in the right room? Why, you know, I'm not in the room with the economic ministers in the G7 or the G20. Am I just not in the right room when those debates are taking place? And he said, no, I am in that room. I am in those rooms, and it's not taking place. And it was incredulous. He said, I know. So, you know, the questions then of what happens as you increasingly, as a development narrative, as a development practice, the job of the UK through the City of London, to which we give taxpayers' money, is meant to promote stock markets and finance, big finance, not just microfinance, in middle-income countries. You know, again, you know, it's not so much the thing in itself, it's how it's located and what the sorts of fabric are. The fabric isn't there. Okay, so someone I always quote, really like a lot, Carolyn Jarvis, they argue that what international development is starting to become is risk mitigation for capital, including financial capital, the escorting of international capital. I love the idea of, you know, kind of the DFID sort of having a young lady on their arms as they take them into Ethiopia and say, don't worry, we'll keep you safe, has become a valued form of development policy, making many large infrastructure projects and other investments proceed with alacrity. I'm not so sure this is entirely true, actually. I think that there's interesting questions around inertia, friction, other things that aren't making that financialization process nearly as easy as the juggernaut that it might appear to be. Okay, some conclusions. So I'd argue that if we take the UK, at the moment at least, we're still seeing the reinvention of international development. Not quite its redundancy, but this is a risky statement to make. It's still possible that we will see a cut just before the next election, for example, down to, say, 0.5% of GDP. People within DFID, and I don't, haven't had the chance to talk about this with Stephanie, who has more know than I do on the inside of DFID, there are people I've spoken to who would argue in some ways it would be better if the UK cut its aid budget to 0.5% and dedicated it to poverty reduction, and said, OK, with the rest, let's go for these new models, these another 0.5 into these new financial models. But what's happening at the moment, I think, is the dilution of, across the board of poverty reduction goals. So the UK continues to seek a leadership role institutionally, ideationally, although with Brexit and with a potential reduction in and in places, the places it needs it most, like China and India, that might not be the case. So, for example, in India, the UK is massively outcompeted by Japan in terms of being able to stump up these attractive, lower-interest, mitigated loans. Below the BRICS, it's seeking strategic partnerships with these frontier markets. It's re-engineering its alliances, like in India. There's this paradox of stronger claims to national interest in what may, I think we have to be cautious about this, it does look like declining public and political support. Finance, not just growth, is the target. We see significant restructuring of DFID, changes in norms and architectures. And we'll see where the future takes us in a very turbulent domestic sphere. So then, has there been a southernisation of development in terms of moving from aid to development finance, in terms of the narrative about poor countries, poor places, moving to win-win and mutual benefit, in terms of collaborating partners rather than recipients, in terms of various other things that I've now forgotten? Well, I think we have to be careful. The UK just can't reinvent itself. It's trying to reinvent itself. The UK would love to be able to do what Japan does, but it can't quite do it yet within its interpretation of development assistance, governed as it still is by the 2002 International Development Act. So institutions like DFID, cultures of aid and giving, representations of development and poverty and so on, can't just be unpicked. So this southern drift is not by any means uncomplicated. This is about convergence as well as southernisation. Of course, different southern partners themselves are changing, and they're changing quite fast, I think. They are also now confronting a situation where 10, 15 years of successful expansion is having consequences on their own narratives and practices and so on.
And as I said before, I think we have to be cognizant of the idea that we ought not just to look at these changes in the context of the last 15 years, in the context of the MDG period, which in some ways could be seen as something of a powerful outlier. If we look back a couple of decades further, there's no shortage of demonstrations of some of these patterns and trends, like, for example, Tide Aid. Anyone over 40 in the room will remember the Pyrgau Dam affair. There's interesting arguments around, in some ways, a return of modernization theories, techno-based optimism. In this case, it's M-Pesa and fintech dev rather than irrigation, perhaps. A central focus on economic growth, particularly around infrastructure. We're also seeing a revival of dependency theories. The amount I talked on dependency theory was starting to shrink in the curriculum just because of so much other stuff coming on board. Dependency theory is now expanding in my undergraduate curriculum because we're back thinking about is China re-indebting countries, or how are countries being re-embedded in very unequal trade relations around raw materials and manufactured goods and so on. And then we see, as I've talked about, Tide Aid, the primacy of national interests and so on.